Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the Democratic nominee for governor, J.B. Pritzker, sits down with us.
You know, what I have stepped forward to do is to really turn this aircraft carrier in a different direction and propel it in the correct direction.
We'll take a look at how Illinois has joined a national trend in electing governors who've never held political office before. And we'll discuss efforts to get more women to enter politics. Also, a visit with a national expert on Legionnaires' disease, and a teacher got her high school students reading with the promise of a trip to a movie.
The biggest problem I encountered was just finding books. And so I just kind of like threw it up on Facebook and people just started sending. And I would say that we had at least 75 books donated and every one of those copies was passed out to a kid.
That and more coming up on this week's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll look at efforts to get more women to run for office. Our education reporter will go to the movies, tagging along with students to see a popular new film with a powerful message. That and more coming up on this week's Statewide. But first up, we've been talking with the candidates for Illinois governor this year. Today, Mary Hansen sits down with the Democrat, J.B. Pritzker.
If you're elected, what will you get done in your first 5 months?
First 5 months. Well, we have to balance the budget of the state, so we've got to make sure that we're reducing expenditures by bringing efficiencies to state government while also finding revenue. And, you know, one of the most important ways to do that is to help create jobs in the state. So I'm going to be working very hard to attract companies and to help people start businesses in the state. I also very much want to work on raising wages and lowering the cost of higher education and lowering the cost of healthcare. And I put out plans for doing all of that and intend to go after those immediately after becoming governor. I would remind everybody that we have real opportunity to put thousands of dollars back on the table for most people in the state by putting forward a public option in healthcare so that they can trade out of their very high-cost healthcare plan and into the state's health insurance system, which is much lower cost. So, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars back on the table for an average family in Illinois. And then by lowering the cost of higher education, and in particular, allowing people with college debt to refinance their debt using a state program that's been done in 12 other states, and we can bring it to Illinois, which again would put hundreds and thousands of dollars back on the table for most people by lowering their interest rates. So those are all things that I think we can work on in the first few months of an administration, and I intend to get them done certainly in the first year or so of my administration.
And when you talk about reducing costs and finding efficiencies, are there any specifics there that you have an eye on?
Yes. So let me start with something I've worked on for more than 20 years. You know, I've been a national leader in early childhood education. By investing in the very earliest years of the lives of the most at-risk kids in our state, we can lower the cost of our K-12 education system, because those kids, when they show up at kindergarten, if they're ready to learn, when they show up at kindergarten, they're much less likely to need remedial programs, much more likely to do well in their third grade reading scores. And then over the long haul, much more likely to graduate from high school and college, get a job, and much less likely to end up incarcerated. And these are not theories. This has been put into effect in other states, and it's been very effective at lowering the budget expenditures associated with these very at-risk kids. So that's one way in which we can bring an efficiency to state government. In our Medicaid system, there are people who have type 2 diabetes, and we can help to prevent it and to treat it much earlier. But under Bruce Rauner, those expenditures have been cut severely, and the result is that people unfortunately need much higher cost care. But if we provide the care much earlier and in prevention, we can lower the cost in our Medicaid system, which is truly hundreds of millions of dollars over a number of these chronic conditions that can be reduced. So these are the kinds of efficiencies we can go after. And then there are some very specific things in government. you know, lowering the cost of the pools of vehicles that the government has. There are some very specific things that I've looked at that bring tens of millions of dollars of savings. But if you do a bunch of them together, you can really add up to a significant amount of the budget.
So moving on to taxes, you said you can lower property taxes. Can you walk us through your plan of how you would achieve that?
Yeah. So I put forward a plan for a fair tax system in the state of Illinois, which would allow us to change the income tax system and shift the burden of paying for schools from local property taxes to the state, which is where it belongs more so than it is today. So just to give everybody an understanding, in the average state in the United States, about half the money that pays for K-12 education comes from local property taxes, and half the money comes from the state. But in Illinois, the vast majority of the money comes from local property taxes, and only 24% comes from the state. So we're very far behind. We're 49th out of 50 states in state funding for education. I want to change that system. And when we do that, we can lower local property taxes. It's a very important thing that I want to do because outmigration from the state of Illinois is occurring in part because of the way we fund our schools and the fact that local property taxes are so high.
So how do you propose changing that?
Well, a fair tax system is a progressive graduated income tax system that would lower taxes for the middle class and those striving to get there and raise taxes on people like Bruce Rauner and me. It's what most states have. It's what the federal government has in terms of an income tax system. And by doing so, we can shift the burden to the state from local property taxes, and then we can also provide exemptions at the local property tax level so that people will actually get a break on their property taxes. And so what does that add up to for most people? For an average family, middle-class family, they'll get an income tax break and they'll get a break on their property taxes.
If I make less than the median household income, will my income taxes go up or go down?
Go down. In fact, that's what I've said. And the vast majority of people in the state of Illinois will get a tax break. And it's the wealthiest people in the state that would step up to the plate under this system.
And so a wealthy person like you, what would be like a percentage that you would pay?
Well, again, you know, during the course of the campaign, what I've said is that we need to make sure we're negotiating this properly with the legislature, and the people of Illinois get to weigh in here too. And so dictating it at this point doesn't make sense, but rather getting input from everybody and making sure that we're negotiating it properly among the legislature so that the people's representatives have a lot to say.
You've made this kind of a centerpiece of your campaign. And so shouldn't people have an idea before they vote for you?
I think what they should understand is that our goal here and my principles for this, and I'm not going to do it if we don't do this, is to lower taxes on the middle class and on people striving to get there.
In terms of changing the tax system, are you supportive of taxing services or retirement?
No. As you know, we have certain sales taxes in place now. But I have said all along, I do not want to expand any taxes on retirement income and do not believe that we should expand taxes on services.
So I have a couple questions on education. Do you support a $40,000 minimum salary for teachers?
I do. I think teachers are worth it. Teachers have very hard jobs. We need to make sure that we're paying them properly, and we need to make sure we're funding our education system properly.
So you've also said that you don't support a new tax exemption for private school scholarships. With millions of dollars pledged already, how would you undo that scholarship program?
Well, it's a five-year program, as you know, and I do want to undo it. At least, you know, my view is that that we shouldn't be diverting funding from public education when public education is still so underfunded. I do think that we should look at the, you know, challenges that people have who want to send their kids to private school, people who can't afford to.
And would you undo that program or would you get rid of the scholarship exemption?
I would.
And how would you do that?
Well, I mean, again, this is a five-year program, so it has its own sunset in it, but we wouldn't renew it, and we would look at, you know, how best to make sure that those kids are taken care of, because you don't want to interrupt their education, you know, 1 year just all of a sudden. But having said that, I mean, it isn't right that we're giving a major giveaway to wealthy people when we still have a public school system that's underfunded.
So shifting over to the campaign, you've given a lot of money to support Democrats up and down the ticket, from Chicago aldermen to downstate Democrats. Are you buying the Democratic Party of Illinois?
No. In fact, I, as you know, for many years, for my whole adult life, I've been supportive of Democrats. I think you know, it's important for people that are running for office that can't afford to support their own campaigns to have supporters who will step up for them. And, you know, I'm a Democrat. I'm always supported Democrats. I'm a progressive Democrat. I really believe that we need to have people who believe in universal health care, that believe in education and higher education, as well as preschool and childcare. And so those are the kinds of people that I've supported and proud to be doing so.
The Democrats that you're supporting, do you expect them to vote a certain way, to vote with you on particular issues if you win and become governor?
No, you know, that it's funny, the narrative that you're describing is what Bruce Rauner has done. Look, I want Democrats to support my views. I'm even going to go ask Republicans to support my views on certain things, and on all of them, but I'll get their support, I hope, on certain things. Look, you know, there's an old saying that Will Rogers said about the Democratic Party, you know, which is, I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat. And that's, you know, how I've, you know, my life has been as a Democrat who understands that there are a lot of different views within the Democratic Party. But the one thing that we really all share in common is a desire to lift up working families and those who are striving to get to the middle class.
So the last 2 years, there's been a surge in grassroots activism and people kind of engaging with the political process, particularly new people on the left, among them, you know, women and young people. You've self-funded your campaign. You've just broken the record for how much money a candidate has contributed to their own campaign. Isn't that kind of enormous amount of wealth? Is that a disincentive for ordinary people who might consider getting involved in public service?
No. In fact, I've encouraged and supported candidates for offices at every level. You know, it's an unfortunate thing that Citizens United and the Republicans have essentially blown up the campaign finance system that had limits. But I really think that we've got to help people who are running for public office, no matter what their own level of income or wealth is.
So when you talk about the campaign finance rules that were, you know, the caps that were lifted, the limits that were taken off, I mean, your campaign is directly benefiting from that by allowing you to donate so much money to it. Are there specific campaign finance reforms that you support?
In Illinois, we can make some changes. For example, we could have a matching contribution program for small contributions in races on most of the ballot. I'm not sure if you know that there's this cap in Illinois. There are limits until somebody writes a check for $250,000 to themselves, and then all the limits come off. And I was not the person who broke the limits in either the primary or the general election, frankly. But I don't think that system works very well. We either need to raise the cap so that it's not so easy for people to break that cap and lift all the limits, or we need to find another way to limit the, you know, contributions people give. And then furthermore, I think there needs to be more transparency in the system. I don't like the dark money that people can give.
So moving on to your campaign, we heard last week that there's a racial discrimination lawsuit against your campaign. Why do you think your own campaign workers sued you over discrimination?
Let me start by saying that the claims that are being made are untrue. We have been very proud of the campaign that we've run. We have a very diverse and inclusive staff. You know, we've got a majority of our senior staff are people of color or women. About 45% of all the staff that we've got all across the state, and we've got more than 100, almost 200 people across the state working on the campaign, and 45% of them are people of color. Juliana and I have made a centerpiece of our campaign, diversity and inclusion, and we are going to have the most diverse administration in the history of the state of Illinois. So I'm proud of everything that our staff has done throughout, and you know, we're going to litigate this thing to the fullest extent of the law because it's just untrue.
And so why do you think that they sued you?
I really don't know.
So last week at a news conference, you said the lawsuit was the first you'd heard of these types of claims about discrimination. There was another former staffer who spoke with NBC Chicago who said that she had raised them. She had raised these concerns to you and to senior staff in the past. She talked specifically about after the phone call with Rod Blagojevich came out, that there was a discussion. Did you have a call with your staff after that tape was released?
Oh, I talked to various people, yeah, after that, of course, but did not get any feedback like what's being alleged in the lawsuit, no.
So her claim when she says that that's not true, that she brought
I don't know what she said to NBC, but I'm just saying that nobody raised issues like the ones that been, you know, the claims that are being made in the lawsuit to me.
She said that if that's the case, then they're saying nobody came to them, then I'm nobody. That was her response to NBC5.
Oh, gosh. I certainly hope she doesn't feel like she's nobody. Nobody came. There's no person that came to me and made the kind of claims that are being made in this lawsuit.
Why is being governor of Illinois worth all of the campaign contributions, all of the money to you?
Well, what's really important here is that we change the direction of our state. What I have stepped forward to do is to really turn this aircraft carrier in a different direction and propel it in the correct direction, making sure that we're standing up for working families. What I think I can do, which is big things for the state of Illinois, I intend to put all of that to work over the next 4 years to make sure that we're truly turning this aircraft carrier in the direction of putting Springfield back on the side of working families.
J.B. Pritzker, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Democratic nominee for governor, J.B. Pritzker, talking with Mary Hansen. You can find our other interviews with candidates. They're available at statewideshow.com. We've made efforts to have Governor Bruce Rauner sit down with us. So far, we've not heard back from his campaign. Coming up next, experience. No longer necessary. Maybe that's even a selling point for high-ranking political jobs. We'll have a report just ahead. And we'll talk about Legionnaire's disease. It can be deadly in some cases. A national expert visited Illinois. We talked with him, and that conversation is on the way. You're listening to Statewide. We're back on Statewide. The upcoming general election will decide whether Republican Bruce Rauner gets another term as Illinois governor or if voters will choose to go with Democrat J.B. Pritzker. But there's one outcome of the election we already know. Illinois will continue its experiment with novice politicians running state governments. Brian Mackey has our Illinois Issues report for this week.
This story begins a few weeks ago in a Chicago television studio. J.B. Pritzker is taking questions from a few dozen high school students on an episode of the local PBS program Chicago Tonight. Early on, he's asked one of the key questions of the campaign.
Why run for governor as your first entry into elected politics? Why not a lower office to gain political experience first?
John, it's a great question. I want to just point out that I've been involved in the political arena for a long, long time.
Pritzker talks about his non-elective experience, like helping launch a business incubator, but he basically rejects the premise of the question, saying he's been around politics a lot. He ends by saying he didn't like the direction the state was going, so
I felt like it was time to step up to the plate.
Pritzker's assertion that he's long been in the political arena runs counter to the Rauner campaign message from 4 years ago. Back then, Rauner regularly boasted of his lack of political experience.
I've never run for office. I didn't even run for student council in high school.
Political scientist Chris Mooney says that kind of message has gotten really popular nationally, but until Rauner, businessmen didn't have much success with it here.
In Illinois, we tend to like our politicians to be professionals. There are places in the country where the guy off the street got a great idea and he's Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of thing.
A perfect man, never in politics in his life, wouldn't know what it was all about in 2 years, let alone 2 months.
That's not our tradition or really our culture. So we have actually been slow to the party on this.
Mooney says Illinois is part of a national trend of really wealthy people going into politics by running for a top office.
It's about 25%. Of all state governors right now are like mega super rich. And about half of those, being governor was the first job they ever had in public life.
Mooney calls these candidates super rich neophytes. He says, as a group, their performance in office is mixed. Some are popular, others not. He says Rauner is so unpopular, he skews the results downward. And there can be consequences to this amateurism. Even one of Illinois' most politically experienced governors says he was taken aback by the challenges of the job.
I had probably as good a resume as anybody going into the governor's office.
Jim Edgar was governor of Illinois from 1991 to 99. After being Secretary of State, the governor's top lobbyist, and a state legislator.
But Jamie, I got to say, a lot of things have surprised me. I can't imagine people that hadn't had any experience.
Edgar says there are ways an amateur politician could help himself in the job. Bring in good people, people who know the history and process of Illinois government, and listen to their advice.
I think anybody who comes in and says, well, I don't know Illinois government, and I don't care because we're going to change it. Well, you better know it if you want to be effective.
Rauner obliquely addressed this point last month in what's come to be known as his reset speech.
I believed a dramatic, aggressive approach could shock state government into shape and bring back Illinois.
But
I underestimated how difficult change can be in government.
Whether Rauner really learned any lessons is something voters will have to decide for themselves. If they go the other way, the past tells us it's likely Pritzker, as Illinois' newest novice governor, will have to learn a few lessons of his own. I'm Brian Mackey.
Earlier this week, our education reporter Dusty Rhodes spent the afternoon at a movie theater watching a popular new teen drama. It was a special screening just for students who had earned the right to be there, organized by one teacher with a little help from the Springfield community.
I know what you're thinking. Using a movie to bribe kids into reading literature is one of the oldest tricks in the teacher playbook. But that's not exactly what was happening with this movie, this piece of literature, and this teacher.
My name is Catherine Jones, but I go by Cassie, and I teach high school English at Southeast.
Southeast is shorthand for Springfield Southeast High School. Among the three high schools in the Springfield District, Southeast has the highest percentage of African-American students.
Sometimes I feel like Southeast has the, I don't know if it's pressure or like celebration of being the black school. And I can't speak for other high schools because I really don't know very many people who go to those high schools or who teach at those high schools. But I know at Southeast, it's okay to be black.
Ms. Jones, who is white, graduated from Rochester High School in a small, prosperous suburb about 6 miles away. But look around her classroom, and it's clear she's made Southeast her home. Over the 8 years she's taught here, she's filled a wall of bookshelves with young adult novels and plastered every surface with snapshots of students holding up their favorite books. She prides herself on being able to match every reluctant reader with a book they'll love and then keep that fire lit. One way she does that is through a book club she started 7 years ago.
The very first year I did it with kids that were like struggling readers. And we were reading this series of books, the Hazelwood High trilogy. And we don't teach the third book, but we have copies of the third book. So I thought it was kind of just like the perfect time to start a book club. And I was like, well, come after school and we'll read the next one. And I'll have snacks and stuff. And then after that, it just kind of spun into its own little thing.
The students choose the book to read. The club went through a dystopian phase with the Hunger Games and Divergent series, and more recently explored LGBTQ issues with Dreadnought, We Are the Ants, and Beautiful Music for Ugly Children.
They also favor books that are being made into movies because they know I'm going to take them or we're going to watch it here. Like last week, we watched All the Boys I've Ever Loved, which is a Netflix movie, but we read the book. And then I had pizza and we watched the movie and that garnered some excitement.
Ms. Jones wasn't aware they had chosen another movie-bound book last year when they selected The Hate U Give. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for young adult fiction, and its subject matter was painfully relevant. The Hate U Give is told from the perspective of a 16-year-old black girl who sees her best friend killed by a white police officer. She then learns to speak out as the only witness to his death. Author Angie Thomas built in subplots like interracial dating, how to handle that friend whose jokes just happen to be racist, and what it means when a family leaves a traditionally black neighborhood to move to the suburbs. Still, the name of the book and the movie forms the acronym THUG. The phrase was popularized by the rapper Tupac Shakur.
You know, his thug life tattooed across his stomach. And he says that thug life is the hate you give little infants fucks everyone. meaning that if you treat a group of people badly since the time they were born, they're going to mess up society and there's going to be issues and you're going to pay for it later. That's thug life.
Ms. Jones learned The Hate U Give had been made into a movie when Southeast alums started emailing her.
Old students just sent me the link and were like, have you seen the trailer? Because I'd like been pushing the book for so long. And they were really excited. And I was like, I got to do something with this.
She promised to take every Southeast student who read the book to see the movie in a theater.
The biggest problem that I encountered was just finding books. And so I just kind of like threw it up on Facebook and people just started sending books to Southeast. And I don't know who sent them. They didn't even have like addresses attached. And I would say that we had at least 75 books donated and every one of those copies was passed out to a kid.
One book went to Quadimian Perry. She told me she was reading it just for fun.
Reading's not a big part of my life. I don't like to read at all, but like I just have to just be really interested in something or I just won't read it.
She finished it just a few hours before boarding the bus to the theater. We'll get her reaction later in this story. Another book went to ninth grader Faith Bondon, who, like Quadamian, said she isn't usually interested in reading, but she sped through The Hate U Give in just 2 weeks. And part of what kept her going was the author's pitch-perfect use of teen slang, a talent rarely found in full-fledged adults.
I think she really did good. Like, if my parents were to try to do it, I'd be like, stop. But, like, for her, it's like, I don't know, it's like she's in our century, but just older. Like, she knew exactly where to use it and how to use it in the right time.
Faith and Quadamian are both Black, but Ms. Jones says white students came asking for the book, too.
All different types of white kids. You got your white kids who hang around Black kids, and they understand the culture, and they understand people. And then you've got your white kids who are a little more segregated, and they kind of just hang out with people that look like them. And those kids were asking for the book. That's what I kind of found astounding and really awesome. One of my favorite things that has happened so far is I have a white student. His science teacher emailed me and said, you got to give Sean a book. He keeps finishing early and he keeps just talking. You got to give him a book. And so I put this on his desk and I said, you need to read this. He said, I'm not, there's no way I'm reading a 400-page book.
Well, that just meant I had to meet Sean. His last name is Skinnendoor. He's 14. How fast did you read this book?
I would say about a week.
Is that faster than normal?
Yes. It usually takes me like 2 months to read a book.
He read the first 3 chapters to his girlfriend over the phone.
Actually, my mom was really surprised that I was reading, and I actually downloaded it on her Kindle for her to read it.
The book never mentions the Black Lives Matter movement, instead substituting a made-up group called Just Us for Justice. But Sean got the message.
I don't believe African Americans get all the equality as we do. And it just kind of bothers me because a lot of my friends are African American, and it could be them one day, you know?
Monday afternoon, 58 students rode a bus from Southeast High to a movie theater 12 miles across town. Every student on the bus had read the book, turned in a report, and paid $5 for a movie ticket. It started off with a scene that wasn't in the book. And for the next 2 hours, everybody in the small auditorium kept a mental tally of where the screenwriter deviated from the book. One addition the students seemed to enthusiastically endorse was a kiss. As the credits rolled, the Southeast kids gave the movie a few courtesy claps. The next day, I checked in with Quadamian.
It was some parts in the book that wasn't in the movie, and it was some characters in the book that didn't even exist in the movie.
But there were chunks of the movie she didn't see because she chose to go sit in the lobby.
The movie was kind of emotional because I was like sitting and thinking like, what if this stuff like will happen to my younger brother and stuff. So like that stuff kind of got to me, and like I wanted my little brother to be there to like see that type of stuff and see that it happens no matter what.
How old is your little brother?
My little brother is 16.
16 can be a dangerous age, especially for a tall child with dark skin. Quadamian gets that. She doesn't need her teacher to connect those dots for her. Ms. Jones just tries to provide a safe place for students to figure things out.
I'm not in the schools pressing my political views or anything like that. I am giving them the opportunity to go see a movie. It's an empowering movie. And it's an empowering movie for Black youth. I mean, the whole theme of the novel is to find your voice. Won't be quiet anymore.
damage can't be undone. Let's not pretend it disappears. We need a change.
I'm Rachel Otwell for Statewide. August Francis is a Decatur resident who teaches sign language to preschoolers. He's also transgender and intersex, and is an LGBTQ activist. He's co-organizing Decatur's Hell No to the Memo rally. A similar one also took place in New York in response to a leaked memo from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services that suggests agencies use strict definitions of gender based solely on physical biology. As an intersex person, Francis says that defies science and his own reality.
My specific intersex variation is called non-typical congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which basically just means that there's a gland in my body that kind of went haywire, and my body started to develop in ways that a biological male's body would, but I was born with what is considered ambiguous female genitalia. So there were aspects of my body and aspects of who I was growing up and everything, like medically, that just didn't fit what female was. So I didn't discover that until I was in my early 20s. And it was when I was 17 that I thought, I'm trans. I obviously don't feel female in any way. So trans fits.
And so how did you find out you're intersex?
It wasn't until I actually met another intersex activist and they were kind of talking about their experiences, and I was like, wow, this is kind of matching up with what I've gone through in my life. Through kind of like my own personal digging, I found other people who have congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Everything on the list was basically a checklist of my entire life. Like, it explained everything that I had gone through, and then I sought out some information from my doctor.
So last week in the New York Times reported on a leaked memo from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services outlining definitions that it wants to use about gender that would basically mean people's gender is based solely on the physical traits that they display upon their birth. And if that's ever to be changed, it needs to be genetically verified. And obviously, what you're organizing is in response to this. Tell us a little bit more about it.
They're suggesting that whatever was on your birth certificate, that is what you are permanently, regardless of if it's been changed, it's as originally issued. That would cause obviously a lot of issues for the trans community and the intersex community. For the trans community, that makes their lives and our lives harder socially, financially, medically, academically. It would cause a lot of problems to have such a strict definition on what sex and gender is. And for intersex people, a lot of us will never fall under that definition. So what does that mean for what we are? What does that mean for who we are? It's a very dehumanizing situation.
And so Jonathan, your boyfriend, right, is here with us, and you're co-organizing a rally that will be taking place on Sunday in regards to this memo. It's one of many all over the country that have been planned in response to this memo. What brings you to the table exactly, Jonathan?
Being an ally of the trans and the intersex community, I just wanted to show my support and show that, you know, they're part of my community and they can't be erased because they're part of the history. Gay men, we have history, but the trans community has a harder history.
Has it been a learning process for you?
Oh, yeah, every day.
And what would you say for those who maybe don't understand the challenges here? You know, maybe they think it's a trend, it's a phase, that sort of thing. You're living it along with August. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to those people?
It's definitely not a trend and it's not a phase. Finding oneself takes years. And some kids find it, or some people find themselves really young, which is great, and some of them don't. It's a challenge that everyone faces, and I say be understanding, listen, and don't force your opinion upon them because you don't know their story.
So, August, what's the main goal here as far as the rally on Sunday and activism going forward?
Education and exposure. Those are the two biggest things right now. Following that is community, getting people together, not just trans and intersex people, but our allies, to kind of start fighting this. Even though it might not seem like a huge deal, it's not like the memo says all trans people need to be exiled, but that's what it could lead to. It's small things like this. It's small microaggressions like this throughout history that have led to some really bad things. So stopping this from happening, educating people, exposing people to who we are, building a community that way.
That was August Francis and his boyfriend, Jonathan Reed, The two are co-organizing a rally in Decatur on Sunday to protest plans in a leaked federal memo that trans rights advocates say would roll back protections for trans and gender nonconforming people. I'm Rachel Otwell.
You're listening to Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. After an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease at an Illinois veterans' home killed 14 residents since 2015, a national prevention group from Washington, D.C. is looking to help. Brad Considine is with the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease. He recently visited Illinois, where he talked to our reporter Daisy Contreras about water safety and the group's mission.
The term Legionnaires has been in the news for several months now, especially after the outbreak at the Quincy Veterans Home. There was also a recent outbreak in McHenry County. As the Alliance tries to raise awareness on Legionella bacteria and how to handle outbreaks, what are some of the misconceptions you encounter and questions that you get from the general public?
So first is people think they only focus on when the outbreaks occur. And outbreaks are only 4% of all the cases. 96% of the cases are individual and sporadic. And so that's one of the fundamental misunderstandings. The other is that Legionella is always harmful to everyone. And in reality, our bodies do a very good job of defending us. It's the immune compromised and people with underlying health conditions that are most vulnerable. So it's important that they understand what that issue involves.
Earlier in the year, Legionella bacteria was found in the water system here in the state capitol complex, right where we are having this interview. Is it common for old buildings such as this one to get bacteria in its water supply, and should we be worried?
We should be concerned, and we should understand it better and put ourselves in position to better manage it. But we should not think of it as any kind of new epidemic kind of issue. Legionella is actually a fairly common bacteria. You can go into water systems and find it. It lives in the biofilm that coats the interior of the distribution system. It comes in through the source water. You know, we work to treat that along with a range of other water pathogens, but it's a very difficult issue to manage. So it exists. So I think what we need to do is to make the topic more normalized, where people understand it. If you think of a topic like salmonella, for example, people understand that if you prepare fresh chicken that you're going to handle it a certain way. It's that level of maturity that we need to have with water, that Legionella is present. How do we mitigate it wherever we find it? And then also what steps people can take to identify it if they think they have a risk, protect themselves if they're immune compromised. And I think if we can get there, I think we can keep this as a fairly manageable type of issue.
So now let's talk about transmission, because that is one of the questions people want clear answers to. Can individuals exposed to the bacteria become seriously ill?
We get exposure to the bacteria, I think, fairly routinely. And so you're not automatically going to get sick. If you have underlying health conditions, I think you're potentially more vulnerable. It is a waterborne illness. The bacteria lives in the water. And ultimately, that bacteria needs to be able to get into your lungs. It's a form of pneumonia. And if it gets into your lungs, it can develop further there and become a very significant issue and potentially fatal. So it gets in your lungs either through aspiration, which is water going down the wrong pipe, or inhaling it into your system. So if you're taking a shower and it's coming out of a shower head, you could imagine that, you know, you would inhale potential molecules of water. If it's contaminated with the bacteria, you might run the risk of contracting the disease.
What was the difference at the Quincy Veterans Home? Was it that the residents were much more susceptible to falling ill after exposure then?
Exactly. The elderly are among the vulnerable groups. Also, just people that have the underlying health issues. So in the last 2 years, the federal Health and Services Organization introduced new regulations that are much more comprehensive in healthcare facilities, for example, because there's a higher rate there because those folks are immune compromised. So yes, the Quincy Home and seniors-related homes are a particular area of concern.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm joined by Brad Considine, who is with the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease, a group based in D.C. We're talking about how the state has dealt with several Legionnaires' disease outbreaks. Brad, you say looking at the water source is important, and in the case of the Quincy Veterans Home, the wells will be replaced.
Well, source water is a big factor. We don't know exactly the extent of the factor, but surface waters have more organics. As you might imagine, rivers and lakes have more organic materials. The bacteria lives off that. If it comes from a well, there's more natural filtration of the water, you know, coming in. If you look at Flint, Michigan and the big water crisis that they had there, a lot of people know that as a lead issue, but they had over 100 people contract Legionnaire's disease. And it's a clear-cut example of how water sourcing and disruptions can drive a large outbreak like they had in Flint. So and they went to the Flint River, right? So you have surface waters with different organics and different makeups. Those kind of changes have downstream effects. We got to study it more. We need to test the water more often for Legionella and advance the science so we can find some lasting solutions.
Do you suggest other homes across the state start looking at their water? And I'm sure they've had cases here and there. But after the Quincy Veterans Home and how big it became, what do you suggest they do?
Well, I think we really need to drive the discussion to include the water utilities that are sourcing the water. And I think there has to be a partnership there. You know, there are organizations that we're familiar with, for example, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, one of the world's greatest water or cancer treatment facilities. You know, they have a partnership with the water utility where disruptions and changes in the water system are communicated, and then they monitor what's going on internally. And it's that kind of partnership that we need to get onto. We do find that the water utilities and so forth really do resist the discussion because it's very challenging and complex on their part. But we really have to force that conversation.
Do you think that the outbreak was handled accordingly to guidelines based on what your experience has been?
Yeah, our observation in Illinois, we were actually fairly impressed that in the state of Illinois, they took a holistic system-oriented view, and they have been working the issue through the system. And I think they concluded with the VA home that the systemic issues were so significant that they're going to just rebuild the campus and develop a new well that supplies not only the campus but also the community of Quincy.
Do you mean this is something that the state should really get involved in, or does the responsibility fall on a senior home who gets to take the first step?
Well, it's a question of leadership, and I think leadership can come from a lot of places, and we shouldn't always just have to think that the government's the only organization that can lead. Certainly the government can play that role. I think we ought to get into it not from a finger-pointing event. The issue's too complex to really kind of expect any positive outcomes from that. So certainly the state and government leaders can be those leaders. Unfortunately, they end up getting caught up in the political side a little bit too excessively. But there's other leadership. In fact, I would say Illinois has done a good job. If you look at the proposal by the EPA that's on the table right now, that's passed through the Illinois Pollution Control Board, they're revamping their water management, water guidelines. They're making some very nice improvements. We support it. They didn't do it just for Legionella. They started this process 6 years ago. And what we find is when responsible people are managing it without all the political atmosphere, they do the right thing on the system level.
Speaking of finger-pointing and politics, you work with a lot of governments across the country, a lot of policymakers. What do you suggest people stop doing here in Illinois? I mean, we've seen some debates with candidates running for governor. The finger-pointing is there, as in, you should have handled this better. It goes beyond that. What are your suggestions?
Well, my suggestion, and I understand politicians are going to do the kinds of things that generate the target outcomes they have for elections. I think the general population ought to understand it's more complex than that and demand, fuller answers and more responsible kind of approaches. Again, I think Illinois, I understand the political discourse that's around it, but if you look underneath, this state of Illinois has done pretty well in terms of taking a system approach, putting in fundamental changes. Illinois is performing at a better level than many other states that we see who other states where they're just trying to ignore the topic. So Illinois is doing, many of the people are doing the right thing at the EPA level. We see really good things.
What is your message for the next governor of Illinois on how to handle the issue of Legionnaire's disease?
I think the message for the next governor of Illinois is to recognize that it's a complex issue, and you know, to put a mix of people around it and not treat it as a political football, because whenever it becomes a political football, people continue to get hurt underneath it, and it takes longer to get solutions, and we start spending money on things that really aren't bringing the benefit, and we really shouldn't waste our time with that. Also recognize that the cases are, a lot of them are individual and spread at cases, not just outbreaks. So those are the kind of topics. I think we really just have to make it about the patients. There's a lot of individuals that are that have become sick and died, really sad, tragic stories, many stories that we could share that aren't investigated, aren't looked at, and that's wrong. We can't just look at outbreaks. And outbreaks are where there's a lot of political pressure and people want to, you know, get off the hot seat, if you will. And that's not the right way to come at it.
Brad, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Daisy. Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Brad Considine with the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease. A record number of women are running for office around the country, so many that some have proclaimed this election another Year of the Woman. We're not seeing that kind of big increase here in Illinois, at least not this year. For Illinois Newsroom, Mary Hansen takes a look at some of the reasons why and what's being done to change that.
Aaron Sentendag and Delaney Flattery were giddy after voting on a recent Saturday.
Most fun test I've ever taken.
I was like, turn it in. We got stickers.
I met them at the Sangamon County building in Springfield. They were both home for the weekend, visiting on break from colleges out of state. I asked them what they thought of the gender diversity of the candidates.
Looking at the ballot, it was a lot of men.
That's Sentendag, a senior at American University in Washington, D.C. Her reaction to the ballot?
Like this again. Like, it's not shocking. It's like one of those things where it's upsetting even if it's not surprising.
The number of women candidates in Illinois continues to climb. But in 2018, the state isn't seeing the same surge as many other parts of the country. Why? For one,
Illinois is just very far ahead of some of the other states. There were already record numbers of women in the Illinois General Assembly.
Debbie Keppel-Momros trains women who want to run for office through a nonpartisan program called Ready to Run Illinois. The state is among the top 10 when it comes to women in the legislature, at 35%. Compare that to around 20% in neighboring Iowa and Missouri, states that are seeing a big jump in the number of women running. Another reason Illinois isn't seeing a similar big jump? Momros says it's money and party power.
It's all about money. It really is. The parties raise the money. The parties are the ones who have the connections to the large donors.
In 200 years, Illinois has never elected a woman governor, and none are running for the job this year. About the same number of women are running for Congress, and there's been only a small increase in candidates for the General Assembly this cycle compared to last. One recommendation from a statewide panel investigating ways to end sexual harassment in state politics could help change that. The call is to elect women to at least half of all political offices.
Of course, we're 50% of the population, if not 51%.
Democratic State Representative Carol Ammons is on the three-member panel.
So I believe, and the other members of the panel believe, that we have to have balanced government. And to balance that government, we need representation to be equal.
So what does Illinois need to do to get there? To start, Ammons says more training for women who want to be candidates, an ability to use campaign funds for things like childcare, and a limit to money in political campaigns. One of the big recommendations from the panel was a culture change at the top.
Right now, there needs to be significant commitment from the leadership of the parties to begin to invest in women candidates up and down the ballot.
Congresswoman Sherry Bustos agrees. She says it's important to get diverse candidates to run for everything from library board to state legislature to Congress.
There are many, many different seats, and part of it is working out some of those things behind the scenes to make sure that we do have better diversity when the winner is said and done.
Bustos started her own training program, Build the Bench. It's targeted to women, young people, and people of color to prepare them for running for office. Back at the Sangamon County polling place, Erin Sendag says she not only saw few women candidates, but she also noticed that many of the candidates on her ballot were unopposed.
And so I really hope that that starts to change over the coming years, because it'd be nice to not only vote for women, but actually have different like choices between those elections.
I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
That's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. And a reminder, you can find this show and past shows at our website, statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.